Good morning, everyone, officially. Welcome to our panel discussion on technology, science, agriculture. Is it a healthy combination? My name is Sarah Brito, and I'm your moderator for this morning. In my day job, I'm also the co-founder of the Good Food 100 Restaurants, which is a nonprofit organization that celebrates restaurants for being transparent with their purchasing practices. And I'm excited to be here today with our esteemed panelists, who I'm going to introduce briefly in just a minute after I read some prepared remarks that the conference has asked me to read. So we're being recorded, so some of this is just to help them in the editing process. So we are panel 5105, Technology, Science, and Agriculture, a Healthy Combination. So before we get started, I'd like to briefly introduce each of our panelists. I'm going to restrain myself from reading their entire bios, which are available in your program and also on the app for the sake of time, so we can focus on hearing from them in their opening remarks. So the way this will work, just to give you an idea of this, we're going to save plenty of time for your questions. This is not like a typical panel discussion where questions get squeezed into the last 5 or 10 minutes. Each of the panelists is going to have an opportunity to give some opening remarks about who they are, their background, and their thoughts on this particular topic. We'll give each panelist about 5 to 7 minutes for those opening remarks. One of our panelists has a video slideshow and some show-and-tell objects. And then I'll give the panelists a chance to respond to each other's opening remarks, which will also give me a chance to scan through the questions. And then we will open up the majority of our conversation for all of your questions. So just to go through and introduce everyone, actually, I'm going to introduce one at a time because I'll introduce and then allow you to talk. Are you good?
Sure.
We're going to go this way. Is that good?
Yep.
We'll save the flashy slideshow for the end.
That's right.
So our first speaker, we're excited, is actually a Boulder local. Her name is Mona Esposito, and she's the co-founder of the Noble Grain Alliance and a local advocate for heritage grains. Welcome, Mona.
Hi. So as Sarah said, I'm co-founder of Noble Grain Alliance, which is a nonprofit based here in Boulder. We also work with other organizations at the state level and beyond. And we are committed to restoring heritage grains and supporting and recreating the network of farmers, millers, and makers that are needed to make a regional grain economy thrive. So in relation to the topic today, since World War II, there have been many efforts to breed and select new modern varieties of wheat that would in turn, increase yields in production and efficiency in processing. But the results of this commingling of technology, science, and agriculture have left us with a food that is devoid of both flavor and nutrition and has left our soil depleted. In this country and beyond, interesting to note that this June marks the first international land race wheat conference to be held in Bologna, Italy. There is a burgeoning movement to return to the wheat of our past, heritage and ancient varieties, to explore how our modern varieties, with their genetic structure and dependence on chemical inputs, are affecting both our health and impacting the environment. So as a food system activist, my passion is in rediscovering and igniting others to get excited about the story of wheat at our table, its journey from sea to table. Wheat as a part of our local food system has all but disappeared in the last 70 years. The infrastructure or grain chain, as we call it, that's necessary for a local or regional grain economy to succeed was lost with the rise of modern industrialized wheats and industrial farming. And along with that, we lost our choices, our right for whole, healthy, flavorful grains. Revitalizing local and sustainable food systems and the heritage seeds that support them is a vital part of rebuilding community and connected food systems. So these grain movements are in response to dissatisfaction with the modern wheats of today.
Great. Thank you, Mona. Our next guest comes to us from California. Pamela Ronald is a professor of plant pathology and at the Genome Center at the University of California, Davis. She is also the author of a book, fresh off the press in the last week, as she was letting me know, and I'm quickly pulling up the title, or I'll let you say what the title is.
Sure. It's Tomorrow's Table, Organic Farming, Genetics, and the Future of Food.
And this is, as I mentioned, hot off the press just in the last week. So please welcome Pamela, and you, the table is yours.
Okay, thank you. So I'm a plant geneticist. I study genes that help the plant survive environmental stress, such as flooding or drought, and also help the plant survive infectious disease. And my husband is an organic farmer, so sometimes people say, oh, you know, plant genetics and organic farming, isn't that the opposite ends of the, you know, agricultural spectrum, and do you even get along? Well, we do. And that's because we have the same goal, which is a sustainable agriculture, producing enough food to feed the world without further destroying the environment. Now, this panel is about technology and agriculture, and I want to perhaps make a point that technology is agriculture. So farming is an artificial system. And what is a farm? It has all kinds of technology, tractors, drip systems, other kinds of irrigation, seed, genetically improved seed. All the food that we eat has been produced using seed that has been genetically improved using some type of method. Crop rotation, greenhouses, we'll hear about. This is all technology. So the question really is not whether technology should be used in agriculture or not, but how can we use it to advance sustainable agriculture? And just to pick that apart a little bit is, you know, we have freshwater systems that are strained. We have arable land that is diminishing. Most arable land has already been farmed, except in a few parts of the world. So one of the key issues is how can we use land and water efficiently? How can we enhance soil fertility? How can we improve the lives of rural farmers and their families and make farming successful, a business, affordable? How can we reduce toxic inputs, enhance food security, and produce food that is affordable? So to me, that is what we should use technology and agriculture to achieve. Thanks.
Thank you. We're next joined by Fred Haberman, and Fred wears many hats, but in his role today, he's here representing himself as the CEO of Urban Organics.
I'm not the CEO of Urban Organics, but I am a co-founder.
Okay.
A lot of people do a lot of the work, and I just take all the credit. Pamela and I were on a panel yesterday, so I'm sure we'll get into the science and technology of genetics and the like. So I'm not going to focus on that right now. So we'll have a nice, fun, I'm sure, conversation around that. Yes, science and technology needs to be a part of how we grow and change our food system. Like Pamela said, we need to be thoughtful and careful about how we deploy technology. With that said, I've spent most of my career in the organic food movement, working with an agency that I co-founded with my wife. We've worked with all kinds of organic brands, from Organic Valley to Annie's Traditional Medicinals and a number of others. We actually have one of the godfathers of the organic food movement sitting right in front of me and in the audience, Mark Retzloff, who's pretty famous for being a co-founder of Horizon and being on boards of most of the brands that you know. As I worked in the organic food movement, I started to become very aware of and having marketed most of the products and brands to actually fairly wealthy people. I started to think I started to learn about this thing called food deserts, that we have 6,000 of them in the United States. And we actually, in the wealthy area of the Twin Cities, which is a fairly wealthy community, we actually have 26 food deserts. The USDA determines a food desert as a place where people cannot obtain easy access of nutritious food. Make a really long story short, a few of us thought about how can we turn this particular food desert in East St. Paul around. And the idea was to deploy a number of technologies. The technology we deployed was to create a contained, closed loop system using aquaponics. Aquaponics leverages a potential symbiotic relationship between fish and plants. So we set out to take a old building, the old Hams Brewery building, and convert it into a farm. And the city helped us. We had a number of people help us. And lo and behold, we now have two facilities, where one facility where we have 200,000 Arctic char that, of course, we raise sustainably in a recirculating aquaculture system. The fish then, of course, create waste. The waste is filtered out. We convert the nitrites into nitrates. The water then has this wonderful organic material that then is pumped underneath these floats that have the plants, the USDA organic leafy greens, basil, romaine, and the like. And we, of course, grow these beautiful, beautiful plants. We're going to do about 400,000 pounds of, we're going to grow about 400,000 pounds of produce this year and about 250,000 pounds of fish in a closed-loop system that only uses 2% to 5% of the water versus traditional organic agriculture. It's, of course, it's not, we don't have to deal with the vagaries of weather and climate change. We have year-round, fresh, hyper-local greens and fish. And as we talk about technology and how we need to improve our food system, water is going to be at a major premium. Food waste is going to, we need to deal with food waste, so on and so forth. So we tried to attack this problem through this closed-loop system in a food desert. Since we've been there, $200 million of investment has poured into this community, and several hundred jobs have been created. More often than not, a food desert is also a business and job desert. So we're trying to stimulate economies, and we believe that we can do this potentially in communities and areas all over the world, and potentially even have 1 million to 2 million square foot facilities where you have protein and nutrition on site in various areas around the world.
Thank you, Fred. Last but not least is another local. Alex McMillan is joining us here. He is the farm manager here at CU Boulder. Did you know that CU Boulder even had a farm manager?
Awesome.
welcome, Alex.
Thank you. So we actually just started harvesting last week. This is a very new facility for us. But we're growing hydroponically. We have 137 aeroponic towers. I have one over here that I brought today. This is our demo unit. It's a little bit smaller than the ones we have in our facility. This is about 4 feet, and then the ones that we're producing in the greenhouse are about 8 feet tall. The crops that we're growing are arugula, red Russian kale. We're growing 8 different kinds of Salanova lettuce. We're growing a whole bunch of different veggies, and the idea behind this is that we're growing this for the students. As you can see, the greenhouse is located on top of the building. We're not detached from anywhere. This is actually on top of the Village Center, which is a dining center over at the Williams Village. So this is what the towers look like. They're pretty big. We have a lot of them. In all, we have a little over 6,000 planting spaces. And the way that these towers work is there's a pump in every one of them, and there's a little rod in between here, and the water is pumped up through the top of it. It hits a little shower cap and breaks down. And this gives us plenty of irrigation for our plants, and they're very happy, as you can see. So in addition to the technology, this is packed with technology. We have an Argus Titan controller system, which controls our climate. I can control the greenhouse from my couch in Lakewood, which is awesome. We have a bunch of LED lights, so if it's not sunny out, I can make it sunny in the greenhouse. In addition to that, we have thermal curtains that double as shade curtains, so in the winter when it's really cold outside, we can pull that shade curtain to give us another layer of air to use as a buffer to keep our temperature in our greenhouse what we want, what the set points. So this is just right before harvest. This is some kale. This is a Siberian kale. And then on the right-hand side, we actually have a red Russian kale. And I did bring some red Russian kale for everyone to try. So at the end, with a little help from our culinary support, we have some red Russian kale that you guys will be welcome to try out. And I mentioned the LED lights, and you might have seen them. They're very bright. You can see them coming in from the top of US 36.
Thank you, Alex. Probably a lot different than the dining hall food that some of you remember from back at college. Before we open it up to questions, I just want to give each of you an opportunity to comment and make any remarks on anything that any of the panelists said in their opening remarks.
I just want to praise CU. I mean, this place is awesome. I love this place. And to be able to have, to grow your food on site year-round, and provide the food to the students and also provide an educational opportunity for the students. I mean, this is a dream that I know we've had, and you've probably had the same dream, but to be able to do it not just in colleges but in high schools, and now there's this green roof law that was just passed here, is that right, in Denver, where you're going to begin to see potentially gardens on these rooftops. And, I mean, it's just fantastic. I just wanted to say that.
I'm curious what got you started on this and why you picked this particular approach, which I've never seen before, the tower approach.
So the idea behind the towers is that we're able to produce a little bit more in the same square footage than we would be able to do in a standard horizontal hydroponic system, so deep water culture, nutrient film technique. We're still able to get a lot of plants in the same area, but we're able to grow them at a much higher density here. So we get more food for the same amount of effort.
And were you producing food before you started this system, or for the cafeterias?
So this is kind of the genesis of the food grown on campus, specifically for CU Boulder. This is, like I said, very new. We pulled down our first harvest last Thursday.
Oh.
So this is very, very new, and we're still working out the bugs.
Good. Good luck.
Thank you.
One of the things I wanted to just ask to get us started that seems to be inherent in our topic, technology, science, agriculture, is it a healthy combination, is how are we defining technology? What is technology? And then I'd love to get to what is healthy. Because it seems to me that at the root of this topic is how one might define technology. And this is a comment for the entire panel, so feel free to take it in any order from your particular perspective.
Well, from my, so we live in the Central Valley of California, which is a very large valley. We produce half the fruits, nuts, and vegetables for the United States. So to me, we live in the Central Valley, very productive agricultural valley, and, we've had a history there. We used to have beautiful native grasslands, vernal pools. Now we have a lot of houses, and we have a lot of food, and so we've destroyed much of the native ecosystem, and why did we do that? Well, we farm because we have to eat. But on the outskirts of the valley are beautiful foothills, and then behind that are the Sierra Nevada Mountains. So in my mind, technology and farms are very, very different than a native ecosystem. So I think that technology is any time that you are using a human-made tool to achieve a particular goal. So we live in a very technology-rich world. And when it comes to healthy, I think it's really important to remember that there's not such a thing as a healthy food or a healthy technology. What's healthy are eating habits. So if you get, your 3 or hopefully 5 fruit and vegetable servings a day, eat some nice grains, eat a little bit of protein, that's a pretty healthy diet, but you don't want to say one particular food is healthy because that doesn't make sense. If you only eat that food, that's not healthy. So that's my view on health and technology.
Anyone else want to comment?
Sure. Yeah, I use technology every day. As you saw, the greenhouse is full with technology. We have horizontal airflow fans, vertical airflow fans. There's swamp coolers. There's ridge vents. So all of this technology really frees me up to focus on the crop and make sure that I'm giving the crop everything that it needs to be successful and to produce a healthy crop. So without the technology that I have, I wouldn't be able to produce as much as I have, and I wouldn't be able to grow a healthy crop without the aids that the technology allows.
Technology is going to be so incredibly important, particularly as we deal with the distribution issues within our system. So some of the less than sexy technologies that need to power and support overall distribution of food to people in need is going to be incredibly important. There are businesses starting to pop up, like MeshX is one of these companies out of Vancouver that, quite frankly, is just taking the food waste, in this case, from commercial producers. This one company, Daya, that has a bunch of products that they can't sell that are still absolutely fine. They might, the cutting machine may have just miscut something, but the food is absolutely fine. They'll put it up online, and then they'll have food banks and the like work with a third-party logistics to get this food to folks. 40% of our food is wasted. Okay, so we have to deal with things like that. I think what the biggest concern for us, just to kind of get it out there, is the sometimes the science and who owns the science and who owns the seeds, and we'll kind of get into that. But right now, who's heard of Monsanto? I mean, we might as well just go there. So should we go there?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. So we've been on a couple panels together, and I'm trying to figure out, because I think Pamela and I in particular have the same vision of wanting to develop a food system that is sustainable. But when you look at, for example, Monsanto, who owns the seeds, and then and their promise was to lessen the dependency and use of herbicides and pesticides and so on, it's actually been the opposite, to the point where 90% of the 90% of soybeans and 70% of the corn in this country has ready Roundup, their herbicide, on the land. That's a lot of land that has these herbicides. And of course, as you know, once the farmers buy the seed, and then indeed they are growing the crops, the Ready Roundup, or the glyphosate that they use, that chemical, the weeds become immune, or you begin to create these super weeds. And now we have 70-plus million acres in the United States that have these lands that have these weeds that are resistant. And then you begin to pour more and more chemicals on the land. And that's a real problem, both for the environment as well as for human safety. Now, there are some varieties, which I know Pam will talk about, that are really interesting, that are not owned by these big companies, that I'd love to have you share if you're open to it.
Yeah, sure. So I work in the public domain. I'm a university scientist, and it was pointed out to me before, not everybody knows what public domain is. Mm-hmm. So we develop seed varieties for the public good. We're nonprofit, so the seeds that I've developed through my collaborators are distributed through national breeding stations for subsistence farmers in India and Bangladesh. So I think there's kind of this conflation of anxiety. Everybody's heard of Monsanto. Everybody knows Monsanto is bad. What does Monsanto do? They do GMOs. But what is a GMO? Their FDA doesn't define it because it's nonsensical. Everything we eat has been genetically modified somehow. Monsanto uses the tools of conventional breeding, such as hybridization, which was developed in the 1920s. They use the tools of marker-assisted breeding. They use the tools of genetic engineering. And so do most breeding groups around the world. So I think there's like this conflation of feelings about it. So there's a concern about particular chemicals. And so there may be a need to advocate to use less chemicals or boycott a particular chemical. But it's important to be precise. Organic farmers also spray pesticides, so it's important to think about the toxicity of that compound. And that's what the EPA does, or used to do at least. And so I think it's really important, hope we can do at this panel, is to tease apart these feelings of anxiety. No one likes to think of a large corporation, yet we give all our data to Facebook, Google, our iPhones. And Monsanto is a very very strong seed company. It's one of the three biggest seed companies in the world, but it's smaller than Whole Foods. And I would recommend that you don't get your information about healthiness from Whole Foods or Monsanto. These are for-profit corporations that are trying to sell you something. And it's not that I'm against for-profit industries. I think you're in a for-profit industry.
I'm pro-money.
Yeah, he's pro-money. So it's not that everybody's going to be a public domain scientist. So it's really important to tease things apart. And so what we do, we some of the work we've done in the lab has led to a rice variety that can tolerate flooding. And this is important because 4 million tons of rice, enough to feed 30 million people, is lost every year to floods in India and Bangladesh. And these are farmers that are living on $2 a day. As the climate changes, floods are predicted to be occur more frequently, creating a greater distress and misery for these communities. So rice grows well in standing water, but most rice varieties will die after complete submergence. So there was a group of scientists that discovered an ancient variety of rice that had an incredible property. It could survive 2 weeks of complete flooding. We were able to isolate that gene and introduce it into varieties that were locally adapted farms in India and Bangladesh and produce a rice variety that can tolerate flooding, that maintains the characteristics of the varieties that farmers have been growing. This variety produces threefold more rice after flooding. And last year, 5 million farmers grew sub-1 rice. And the benefits are accruing primarily to the poorest communities. So there's a caste system in India, and the lowest caste people for generations have had the most flood-prone land. So they're reaping the greatest benefits. The seed is in the public domain. It's distributed through normal channels, through breeding institutions. You know, Monsanto is not interested in poor farmers in Bangladesh and India. Yet this fear and this kind of almost hysteria about Monsanto is preventing access to technology that the very poorest people in the world can most benefit from. And so hopefully we can talk a little bit more about it, but I hope you understand a little bit more about seeds.
Well, yeah, that's a great description. I just wanted to clarify that while Whole Foods might be about the size of Monsanto, Monsanto supports well over $100 billion in crops that use Roundup. Okay, so we have to look at the influence that they have. Now, the main point, though, that I agree with Pam is that it's a complex, feeding the world is complex, and but there should be some hysteria related to that amount of land that has chemicals on it. It's just very, very, very alarming. Now, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't look at other alternatives. And, I mean, just because we say Monsanto and GMOs, that doesn't mean all these programs are the same. And so I think we're absolutely on the same page with that.
Well, along those lines, we have a question from the audience, from someone who is on the front lines of educating people. And the question is that I'm personally responsible for educating the public about sustainable agriculture. So my question from the audience is, are GMOs good or bad for sustainable agriculture, small farmers, and biodiversity? How do I answer that question for the students? How does this educator?
I think it's really important to understand that every crop, every seed has to be looked at on a case-by-case basis. Mm-hmm. There's not really any such thing as a GMO, so asking that question is already going down the wrong track, I believe. You need to ask specific questions about specific crops. Is submergence-tolerant rice beneficial to poor farmers in India? Well, I think most people would say yes. How was it developed? It was using a modern technology called marker-assisted breeding. Is that technology itself, is the process harmful? No, every major scientific organization has concluded that the process of marker-assisted breeding or genetic engineering is no more risky than other approaches. Then you can consider BT eggplant. So how many of you have heard of BT? So BT is a really important crop. It's a really important concept because this idea of GMO has gotten caught up with this chemical applications. And it is true that there are glyphosate is being sprayed to control weeds. But there's another major application that surprisingly most people don't know about. So BT is an organic pesticide. So it's certified organic. It's sprayed on crops. My husband's used it. Many people use it to control pests because organic farms have pests as well. And what's interesting about BT, it's harvested from a soil bacterium, is that it's non-toxic to humans, to fish, to other wildlife. It's very specific to pests. So there's eggplant farms. So eggplants in Bangladesh are the most important vegetable in the country. But eggplant farmers have been spraying chemical insecticides 2 or 3 times a week, sometimes twice a day, to control a very serious pest that, if not controlled, will destroy the eggplant crop. This has been going on for years. If you go down to Bangladesh, you will see children, young children, with insecticide sprays, spraying insecticides with no protection. That's why the World Health Organization estimates that 300,000 people die every day from misuse or overuse of insecticides. Now, organic eggplant farmers in Bangladesh don't have access to spray BT. You know, it's a corporate product. It's very expensive. You can't even get it in Bangladesh. Farmers can't afford it, and it's not effective at preventing the insect from getting inside the eggplant. So Bangladeshi scientists, in collaboration with Cornell scientists, genetically engineered an eggplant to carry the BT gene. It's been planted for 4 years. Farmers in Bangladesh have reduced their chemical insecticide sprays nearly down to zero. So it's not that it's a silver bullet. You know, the farmers still need to use agroecological practices. They need to enhance the diversity of their farms. But they're now able to not spray chemical insecticides. And I think this sort of fear about, you might think, okay, well, maybe it's not so bad, but I don't like GMOs, so I'm going to stay away from them. And I'm going to buy non-GMO products. But that is harmful to farmers in less developed countries because this kind of activity here from people that are well-fed and have enough to eat really prevents access to those technologies. And there's just a lot of examples of that. And even here, this sort of non-GMO label is very harmful because it's true that alfalfa farmers in California are now planting alfalfa that allows them to spray Roundup, an herbicide. So, okay, you might think, oh, you know, I don't like Roundup. But they're only spraying twice a season, and glyphosate is considered to be less toxic than BT, than organic farmers spray. Mm-hmm. Now, what's happening with this non-GMO label, and we have a local farmer. He has a very, very large farm. He grows organic, conventional. He used to grow herbicide-tolerant alfalfa. He said the milk industry in California is now demanding non-GMO. Non-GMO is not certified organic. You must keep this in mind. That means that non-GMO, he is now going to spray a witch's brew of chemicals. And that's the words of Dan Charles on NPR. He doesn't spray glyphosate twice a season. He sprays a witch's brew of chemicals every year because that is now what the public is demanding by the non-GMO label. And it's not what you think you're demanding. But that is what's happening, and there's growing evidence for this and growing stories for this, and it's really harmful. So why do they spray any herbicides? Because if you feed weedy alfalfa, so weeds reduce yield for one thing. Land is precious. Water is very precious in California. So if you have a farm that has a lot of weeds, it's not so great for the ecosystem. But also, you can't feed alfalfa, weedy alfalfa, to horses. They will get very sick. Mm-hmm. So they're spraying these very toxic chemicals. When I grew up, there was a lot of talk about paraquat. It's very toxic. There's a lot of data on it, but that's where farmers are going back to 1950s farming because of these sort of misinformation that people are getting from groups that are really just trying to make a profit.
Just switching gears a little bit. Just because I want to expand the conversation beyond Fred and Pamela. Jumping over to Alex. We know that there is a lot of talk about, and actually, Fred, you'll probably be able to speak to this as well, but there's a lot of buzz around indoor farming, urban farming, ways to do farming. The question from the audience, there's two that are interrelated, which is around using artificial light for agriculture seems to be highly inefficient. And then what are the challenges with mold and pests when you move indoor farming? So I guess, you know, underlying a lot of these questions, and I may not be asking your question verbatim, but there's a lot in here. You know, are we basically trying to solve one problem from land-based farming and creating a new problem with these more urban solutions? So maybe, Alex, you could start, and then, Fred, feel free to chime in from an aquaponics perspective.
Sure. Before I took the job at CU Boulder, I was actually managing a vertical farm, so this is something I feel very comfortable with. So the artificial light, you're correct. You're not using the sunlight. We're using a carbon source to grow our plants, which probably isn't the most effective use of resources. So personally, this is why I like the aeroponic towers, because it allows me to be in the greenhouse, use the sun, which is natural. It's free. I'm not offsetting any carbon. And the way that I utilize the lights in the greenhouse, going back to the logic-based controller that I have for the greenhouse, my lights are set up so that I run my lights from 6:30 to 9 only if my sensors have found that it has not been enough light. So I have a metric that if it hits X amount of light in a day, my lights don't go on because the plants got all of the light they need. So I'd like to personally see more of this, because I think this is the way that we need to go forward to be sustainable and not be using carbon to grow plants when the sun is free and natural and not polluting our environment. To go back to the mold and pest question, it's challenging. Running an IPM program in a vertical farm is challenging because you don't have the ability to scout. You know, when everything is stacked on top of each other, my ability to actually visually inspect the entirety of the crop is negated just because I can't physically get in there. So one of the ways that I would treat pests would be to use good bugs. So I'll have usually weekly we would bring in, depending on the insect pressure, 3 to 4 different species of insects that are all very predatorial, and they go after a certain insect. So if I had fungus gnats, I would get a specific insect for fungus gnats. If I had white flies, same thing, I would get a predator for white flies. So keeping that ecosystem in check is really important. And as far as the mold and the disease pressures, that goes back to the air quality. So making sure that we have really good air quality in there circulating. A lot of these places are using really medical grade ventilation systems. So they are capturing the mold spores. You know, you're not going to be able to grow a plant without some sort of disease pressure or insect pressure. It comes with the territory. So I think being able to know what the variables are and how to deal with them in a confined space is really the key to success when you're growing indoors and vertically.
Awesome answer. The only thing I'll add is that it was a really, really good question, and usually I bring it up right away. With these closed systems that use LED lights, it's not that's the challenge. That's the problem right now with our system. The next iteration, which is my dream, is to have the entire facility, the future facilities, use nothing but solar energy. To me, getting back into technology, solar energy is the answer to a lot of challenges. I mean, my hope is that we're using solar, that we have solar energy in our homes, we have solar energy that's powering our car overnight, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But if we could, I'm hopeful, actually, to create a facility potentially here in the high desert to prove to the world that you could have one of these self-contained systems, once again, using solar energy and only using 2 to 5% of the water. I think that would be an incredible proof point for replication in other parts of the world.
Related to this, use of technology. This question comes from the audience, and it says that I believe in local agriculture. So how do we support small farmers and specifically support the labor pool? So we're talking about all this new technology, and as I was looking at the slides, I was thinking someone has to learn. Alex, you had to learn how to use all of that stuff. The question is about how do we restore skillful and respectable labor into this job pool that is becoming more and more technologically advanced? Any thoughts on technology and science's impact on the labor pool?
I think personally the trend in agriculture has been going away from labor and going sort of more to automation as wages rise and the labor is harder to find. I see more and more farms opting for the $250,000 transplanting machines that can outpace people. Not to say that, you know, the technology is coming for your jobs, but in agriculture it sort of is. But I think the use of technology and labor is a very sour subject in agriculture because it can be hard to, if you have acres of field, you know, how are you going to harvest these crops with just people or, you know, working on a farm, your margins are very small. So you really have to be mindful of how you spend your money and how you spend your labor. So the trend that I see is sort of more specialized people such as myself or other growers that are able to grow. You know, I could grow a couple acres of greenhouse by myself if I needed to. Hopefully I don't need to, but I think that's sort of where we're headed.
Well, maybe I'll just give it perspective from the developing world where most of the farmers live. Something like 80% of the world's farmers live in less developed countries, and they are still doing a lot of labor. And so when they're able to have some type of advanced technology, it can help them in ways that we don't really think about here. So, for example, the submergence-tolerant rice, we're able to meet some of the Bangladeshi farmers who said now they not only had enough seed to feed their enough rice to feed their families, but they had a little bit extra to sell. And so they were able to use that money to perhaps buy some vegetables that they haven't been able to afford or to diversify their crops. Or one of them said, send their children to school. So that's how technology can have a direct and positive impact in the less developed world.
I want to jump over to Heritage Grains and have a chance to hear from Mona again. There's a few questions in here. And the questions are really wondering if the desire for Heritage Grains is coming from, in part, the gluten intolerance epidemic. And can you speak to, the question of is the hybridization of wheat one of the contributing factors to this? And what is the sourcing challenges in getting these, and as Fred was mentioning, the distribution and sourcing challenges to getting these heritage grains back in the mainstream market so that they're accessible?
Okay, that was a big question. I'll speak first to the gluten intolerance epidemic. There is both anecdotal evidence and research that is starting to come to the forefront that many of the issues that we are having with gluten have to do with the modern varieties of wheat that were developed in the Green Revolution. And they were developed both for production for high yield and for processing needs. The roller mill, you needed grains that matched the processing technique that stood up to these intense forms of processing. And beyond that, the conversation goes to the kind, not just the wheat, but how it's being consumed and the form that wheat, well, I'll just pick wheat, is coming to us, highly refined, so devoid of the fiber, the bran, the germ, the nutrients that actually are beneficial to our system. And then a lot of just quick white breads. I think it's established that as humans, our systems actually do have a hard time processing gluten. So thousands of years ago, someone figured out this sourdough starter, so that long fermentation introduces enzymes that actually help break down these proteins. So gluten is just a protein. So I think a combination of losing sight of the kind of wheat, the processing, and, you know, how it's coming to our table, and add to that the chemicals that are used for modern wheats and large monocrops of wheat. So all those things, I think, are disturbing our system and creating this. And this is not at all speaking to celiacs. This is speaking to the rise of gluten intolerance. And so what I would say, which is just a little bit going back to what Pamela was saying initially about, you know, how can we use technology to advance sustainable agriculture? How can we look back at history and these heritage grains and ancient grains and the way they were grown and their genetic makeup to take the best parts of that seed, which is what, you know, this hybridization idea, you know, it's just it for thousands of years or more, you know, people, mostly women, have been going out into the field, selecting the best seed for whatever they were looking for, yield, flavor, drought tolerance, saving those seeds, and then planting them again. So this has been going on forever. So how can we sort of walk that gray line where we don't say this GMOs are bad, this is good, science is bad, this is good? You know, how can we look at history and, you know, take what we've learned and, you know, this knowledge that's actually inherent in these seeds and apply it to the modern issues we are having today and use technology for good? You know, how can we come up with solutions for climate change and yield and flavor and nutrition and develop seeds? Because there are modern land races that are being bred and developed in the lab and in the same way that you would have gone out into the field and selected seed for those traits.
Here's something that's really interesting that being a big organic advocate, here's an inherent contradiction, that a situation that I'll paint. If your child was dying of cancer, and there was a gene editing opportunity that you could take to save your child, would you do it? Probably, I would. But when it comes to gene editing with food, it spooks me. However, primarily because of the propaganda, but most specifically to the chemicals that we're putting on the land. Okay, but when it comes to food, we get a little spooked out, and I'm wrestling with that question of saving my child, let's say, versus what we're putting in our what we're doing genetically to the seeds. It's really an interesting question to live within.
Well, a question from the audience along those lines is, you know, they love the story about how it helped with rice, but at the end of the day, the question is, are GMOs safe? And then a related question is, you know, does the application of Roundup glyphosate interfere with cover crops on dirt? Are there other implications that we need to be aware of?
So the process of genetics, whether it's taking an ancient land race and introducing the genes from an ancient land race into a modern variety using marker-assisted breeding or genetic engineering or you know, creating new varieties using chemical mutagenesis, which is, or radiation mutagenesis, which is certified organic. These methods all have, obviously, risks of unintended consequences, but breeders do this because of the benefits to farmers and consumers. And the risks are no greater for modern methods than older methods. And in fact, the National Academy of Sciences ranks the older method of radiation mutagenesis as the most risky in terms of unintended consequences. And it's not that hard to understand, because when you use radiation, you introduce a lot of breaks that aren't characterized in the genome, a lot of mutations. But, you know, we have 25 different varieties that have been developed that way. No one's been harmed, as far as I know. It's certified organic. So I think it's important to not be so concerned about the genetic process. Like, it's sort of a distraction to think about genes in our food. And I think what's really more important is to think about the quality of the food. Are you getting your whole grains? Are you getting your fruits and vegetables? And I think the conversation has a little bit gone the wrong way and is really distracting us from the really important aspects of sustainable agriculture.
We keep getting derailed on this, but going back to who owns the seed?
Can I actually jump in there just because we have a question, and so this will maybe just add some momentum to what you're about to say. So I haven't fully read this through, so let me just bear with me here for a second. But sustainable food systems has as one of its legs is economic justice. So how is it just for large corporations to own the seed that needs the chemical that they make and thus forces farmers to pay higher prices for the seeds and the chemicals? So even maybe in the case, Pamela, as you mentioned, where in some cases farmers are receiving seed for free, but it puts them into a system that then they're forced to buy the chemicals. So the question really is, you know, when we bring food justice into this conversation about science, technology, and agriculture, is it just for large corporations to own the seeds and then force farmers to use the chemicals?
So I think that's a misconception. So the submergence-tolerant rice, there's no chemicals used. It's a trait that gives environmental stress tolerance, so the plant is able to live through a flood. So there's no chemicals involved, and there's no corporations that own the seed, okay? And the farmers can self-pollinate their seed, and it's the same situation with BT eggplant. Farmers are given the seed that in the local community. They self-pollinate their seed. They're using less chemical insecticide. So I think there's, again, this kind of confusion. And you're talking about one particular application, which is herbicide tolerance. And those are seed for farmers in the United States and Europe, because subsistence farmers don't even really use herbicides. They can't afford it. They don't have access to these, often these kinds of chemicals. They hand weed. So again, it's really important to be specific. And why do farmers? And so, in the developed world, farmers are buying these herbicides. It's one type of seed, herbicide tolerant seed that's very popular with farmers. And again, this is very typical. We don't have any farmers on the panel. I mean, you guys are farmers, but it's a special farm, a nice farm, but it's not like it's not feeding the world type of farmers. And those farmers are hardly ever on the panel, but you can ask them, why do you buy the seed from Monsanto? And my husband is a farmer, so organic farmers also buy their seed from Monsanto because Monsanto sells a lot of the seed. There's only a few companies to choose from. So you ask a farmer, any farmer, why are you buying seed? And they will tell you they're buying seed because they see benefits. So this idea that farmers don't have the ability to reason, I think is harmful to the image of farmers. Farmers make their choices, and they're not forced to do a particular thing. So, again, there's like kind of a lot of different ideas, a little bit of truth mixed in with a lot of kind of confusion and misinformation, which is common.
You take the rice example, that's one example. There are many, many examples.
Exactly.
I'm about to say something different.
Yeah. No, there are many examples.
There are many examples of people getting hooked on Monsanto seeds.
Who? Why?
Because somehow they purchased them, or the government may have purchased them, a grant program, any number of
programs. No, they purchased them.
It could have been a grant program. It could have been any one of these programs where these smallholder farmers and then they'll have weed resistance, and then they start losing diversity of their seeds.
Why don't they just plant something else if they don't like the seed? So that's where I think there's this idea of a farmer not able to make decisions. And I know a lot of farmers. I've never met a farmer like that.
I've talked to farmers.
Really?
Yes.
Tell you they're hooked.
No, but they tell me about how the weeds have come up, and pretty soon they have these super weeds, And they're like, what did I just do? What did I just do to my land? What did I just do to my community?
Well, they're absolutely, anytime you spray a huge amount of any kind of pest control, whether it's an herbicide or a BT pesticide, absolutely you get this evolution of resistance. And that's why you need to have an integrated farm system.
I don't disagree that like, I love your rice example. I do. I love it. But the main point is, boy, there's a lot of education that needs to take place with our food system.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you can't just make these sweeping generalizations, which
exactly.
We love to do.
Yeah.
So we agree on that.
Yeah, we always agree. We can always come to agreement.
I want to redirect the conversation to some student questions that have come in more about the healthy part of our topic today. And so the question is really around, you know, like, what is healthy? Is a vegetarian diet more healthy than a non-vegetarian diet? And another question from students is around, you know, what in general do you all consider the most effective diet for someone who is trying to ensure the ethical treatment of animals, sustainable production, and sufficient healthy nutrition,
you know, there,
and not make a trade-off?
Well, I interpreted the title of the talk as the technology, science, and agriculture, : a healthy combination. So not, I'll speak to that, but not so much as that being a separate discussion. So the question was, I came to a panel here a couple of days ago that had to do with climate change and how it's affecting the farm. And there was the gentleman from the Netherlands who said, you know, the biggest thing you can do is stop eating meat. It's one thing you can do, and it'll have a huge impact. The amount of land, the amount of water that's used to raise industrial meat for consumption it's huge. You could have a huge impact. So I think it depends on... You have to look at a lot of different things, and it's also probably healthier for your body. So I think it's a really big question about.
Alex, I'm curious from your perspective, like in students, what trends are you seeing among students that the dining services is being forced to respond to?
So the dining does a great job at providing healthy options. They provide sustainable options, and we really go out of our way to make sure that the students and the staff and whoever is dining with us has choices. They have a variety of options. We have, you know, gluten-free, vegan. We have our A9 identified, so if you're allergic to something, you know that it's in this or it's not in this. All of our fish is sustainably caught and sourced. We do sea to table. Our beef is never, ever beef. Our chicken is always antibiotic-free, and we also look into the agricultural practices from the farms that we source. So it is possible, and we do a really great job of that here.
Great. Some questions have come up. There's a few here that are going back to urban versus rural agriculture. What are the advantages and disadvantages of urban versus rural agriculture? And then sort of a related question is, will technology someday ultimately reduce the need for arable land altogether?
Those are big questions. I want to shift just for one second away from land and talk a bit about ocean, oceans. It's almost criminal what we've done to our oceans. You can't even believe, I mean, if you just spend a couple hours Googling what we've done around with our oceans, you begin to just become horrified. I don't like the fact that I'm eating fish in general from a land-based recirculating system, to be honest with you. However, I'm also spooked by the fact that the fish that we get and from the oceans, more often than not, are ingesting all kinds of toxins. And we're going to need technology to help us create land-based, sustainable systems to raise our fish. And by the way, it's one of the most efficient animals in terms of the feed conversion ratio. 1 pound in, 1 pound for a fish eating various food is 1 pound of flesh versus cows, which is 6 to 1, 7 to 1. Very, very, very important protein that is very, very efficient. And when you talk about urban farms and urbanization is going to go on a rampant pace in the next 20 to 50 years. We're going to need to set up these localized urban systems. We need arable land. We have to do it. The population keeps increasing, but we also need to set up these urban systems, the rooftops, vacant lots, you name it. But also we need to have these fish farms. Quite frankly, not all farms are created equal. The system that Pentair, this Fortune 500 company, created for us is unbelievable. Some of the cleanest fish you could eat. So anyway, I just want you to think about the seas, and this is a really, really important point.
Maybe I can just add, I think the innovation is really important, and it's also really exciting to have that here on campus for students. And you're just starting, you're going to see where it goes, you probably make lots of changes. That's the nature of innovation, of technology. One greater question I think always comes up is this idea of life cycle analysis. When you consider all the plastics and all the water and all the energy and all the lights, how does it balance out from bringing a truck from California? Mm-hmm. So it's probably not something we can answer right now. And in my understanding, in some scenarios, it works very well for greens and cities, provides a local source and a lot of other benefits, obviously, in terms of education, getting people excited about plants and plant biology, which I'm always for. But I think right now there's not really an ultimate answer to that question. And it's just that we do need to use land and water much more efficiently than we have been, whether it's on arable land in California or a artificial environment on a rooftop. In both cases, it's really important to be efficient and maximize the sustainability.
Yeah. Somewhat related to that, and Pamela, while you're talking, a question came in asking, is there an opportunity for technology to improve the efficiency of photosynthesis itself?
So that's a very good question. So photosynthesis is obviously very important. It takes carbon dioxide from the air, creates sugars that are important for energy production, and releases oxygen to the air. And plants have two different ways of doing photosynthesis. One's less efficient than the other. And there's a big effort. It's been along my entire career, actually, been talking about, see if we can make photosynthesis more efficient. There's a big Gates Foundation grant to a group trying to do this. It is very difficult, so it's not a low-hanging fruit. Let's just say it's up there with, how many of you heard of nitrogen fixation? Mm-hmm. It's very important for, that's why people cover crop to... the symbiotic association, plant roots with bacteria, produces nitrogen, so you don't have to add as much. And added nitrogen is very important, but not all plants do that. So these are the two, huge goals in plant biology. Can we make photosynthesis more efficient, and can we make rice plants fix their own nitrogen? And there's a lot of skepticism in the scientific community, but there is... Bill Lindman and Gates are supporting both projects, and I'm in favor of those projects because, it's not even like a moonshot, not even like a Mars shot, maybe Jupiter. But it doesn't mean it's impossible.
So I'd like to kind of comment on that. I think it's like she said, it's hard to improve the actual photosynthesis of a plant, but since we're talking about the sunlight, there's actually a couple companies that are working on greenhouse panels. So there's a company out of California called Soliculture, and they're working on photovoltaic panels that will actually allow greenhouses to power themselves. These panels actually conduct electricity. So a grower can set up these panels on his greenhouse. They turn the greenhouse pink. It's pretty weird looking. But the grower is then able to capture energy from the sun as well as give the plants the sunlight they need, and they can use this energy to power their greenhouse, making them more sustainable. Additionally, here at CU Boulder, in our Department of Mechanical Engineering, they're currently working on scalable, cost-effective greenhouse materials that splits sunlight into photosynthetically efficient light for the plants, and then it will repurpose the inefficient infrared light to aid in water purification. So this will sort of allow us to still grow plants, but it will also give growers maybe who need a little bit more help. They don't have the million-dollar greenhouses. This will give them a technology to give their plants really clean water, which is vital for growing.
The systems that we talk about are going to be very, very important. Obviously, they're just a small variable in the overall equation of feeding the world. But when you look at what's happening with climate change, it gets very, if you have arable land and you're a farmer and you do every single thing right, it's one of the first occupations, one of the only jobs where you can do everything right and still get just screwed. And so because of maybe a flood or because of you name it. And, of course, they're having more and more dramatic weather patterns. Contained agriculture will play a role, maybe not a massive role, but it will play a role, particularly as we begin to think about how we're going to accommodate all these people more than anything in these urban areas. Mm-hmm. So, once again, it's complicated. We have to talk to city planners. We have to begin having these larger visions, not just in our country, of course, but in other countries.
Speaking of speaking to civil planning, we have a question from a civil and environmental engineering student who asks, what are some of the changes to infrastructure related to farms and other forms of agriculture that you all expect to come in the future that would be relevant to a civil and environmental engineering student?
I'm really excited about the idea of being on a subway and being able to use your cell phone and at one stop, and then push a button, and then get on the next stop and pick up your urban groceries. And it's happening. It's happening in Japan. And so there might be, for example, a building dedicated to all kinds of food that might be grown next to your stop, and you just pick it up. I mean, the future, as we know, is all going to be about just pressing a button and getting it in your home, getting it this, there, and the other. But we need to be thinking about, talking about food deserts, like I said, there are many, many, not just, of course, in urban areas, but also in rural areas. How are we going to develop transit systems and provide people with healthy food in an efficient way? Right now, for example, in the Twin Cities, it's just one huge sprawl. And so we need to be thinking about how we can provide these centralized food centers for people that are easy to access. And the civil engineer probably knows a lot more about this than I do.
Surprisingly, we're just getting to a conversation around carbon emissions. Hasn't come up yet. And so the question is related to these more tech-focused productions. How are you measuring the carbon emissions and efficiency of these indoor systems?
You want to take it? Well, the short answer is I'm not entirely sure. But basically, it would be the inputs that go in there. So what inputs, you know, electricity, we have our water, we have any chemical that we would use, and we have seeds. So how are we measuring the carbon if you're trying to say that the greens produced in a vertical farm are better or inferior than a greenhouse? I think you have to really weigh everything, all the environmental factors, all of the production costs. That's a trickier question. And I'm not sure that a lot of places are doing this, because I think when you see local agriculture, you know, hey, it was grown in Lakewood down the block, that kind of supersedes maybe the carbon footprint, because you're getting things local, it's fresh, you're helping the local economy. I think there are other ways maybe that it the carbon would be offset. So maybe the social aspect of it, employing local people. There are a lot of factors that might sort of offset the fact that they do use carbon for it. It would just depend on how you measure it.
Once again, it just goes back to, for us, you know, I don't like the amount of electricity we use, and that's why solar is, you know, this is a very, very, very iterative process, and to me, solar energy is going to be a big key for all of this.
A question came in around concerning the 40% of food waste. How do each of you think that technology can help educate people so that they can make a difference and reduce this 40% food waste number?
I just kind of want to shine a little light on what we're doing here at CU Boulder. So every month we have a Scrape Your Plate Day. So the students, when they're done eating, before they put their tray on the tray return, they're actually forced to scrape out their plate and the organic matter, and then we weigh it and we post those results. So at the end of the month, they're seeing exactly how much they're throwing out. Are they improving? Are they getting worse? So we're tracking that, and we're kind of showing that to them. In addition to our food waste, we do a lot of composting, and over at the New Village Center where the greenhouse is located, we actually have a biodigester. So we're able to take that food and put it in the biodigester and sort of speed up the process of breaking it down and turning it into a very organic product.
That's great. Cool. Great example.
CU is awesome.
Another question from a student. I'm very interested in supporting developments in agricultural technologies, but I'm wondering how these developments will affect the price of food. Can these technologies make high-quality, healthy food more accessible to lower-income folks?
That's what we do. I mean, I think that, you know, again, it's depends on the farming system. At least for farmers in less developed countries, you know, there's some basic seed technologies that can have a huge positive impact on the livelihood. As I mentioned, the lower caste farmers are doing much, much better with the advent of these technologies. But maybe the question is more directed towards these kinds of indoor technologies. Mm-hmm. And whether you can produce food that's you'd be able if you sell it, could be price compatible with my husband's organic greens from California.
So I think one of the problems with competing with these big farms is the big farms have a lot of money. So dropping a couple million dollars on a new greenhouse is kind of the standard application. But what we're seeing in the product climate is we're seeing a lot of the technology that used to cost tens of thousands of dollars is now coming down to a price point where the everyday farmer could use it, or someone who just has a closet in their basement that they're growing something in, they could use that technology, and it mirrors the same technology that we would use in these multi-million dollar greenhouses. So the technology is becoming more available to the general public, and I think we're seeing a lot more with with some of the homebrew kind of developed apps. We're seeing a lot more of tying that technology in a very economic fashion.
Some of the most innovative technology is coming from the weed industry.
It is.
Quite frankly. Mm-hmm. So that's positive. Mm-hmm. But one thing I think you'll end up seeing is that as the farmers that have been growing, say, organic, conventional, you know, organic or traditional organic, I believe that as these technologies become more and more affordable, and as climate change continues to create more and more dramatic weather, you'll see farmers diversifying their the way that they grow and produce food. You'll begin to see these facilities not just in urban locations, but much larger facilities, for example, on their land, so they can diversify their portfolio. You'll also begin to see these systems. We're already looking at developing these types of systems close to distribution centers, like an Amazon distribution center. So you'll begin to see many of these technologies, both you know, on demand with Amazon, for example, all as well with these contained, highly efficient systems, as particularly as prices go down. So it'll be cool. It'll be a fun future.
Another question from a student came in asking about is organic farming even possible as we think about feeding a planet that's growing towards 9 billion people?
Well, I think one nice thing about organic farming is it's certified by the USDA, so you can actually go and read what, you know, what the regulations are. So it's a real thing, unlike non-GMO, sorry about the rant there, but which is not certified. And so the USDA, actually, you can read what it is. And so I think that's really a great start. So the issue with organic, so right now it's about 0.5% of calories in the United States is from organic. And the reason primarily is that most of the organic food that we eat is things like greens that don't provide that many calories in the first place. And the other issue is that depending on the crop, there's some crops that are certified organic that yield 100% as the conventional counterpart, but in general, the yield's about 25% less. And that's because organic farmers have challenges, like all farmers, how to control pests and how to control weeds. And I think there's estimates that if we converted everything to organic agriculture now, we would have no wilderness left at all, no rainforest left. So I think the question is not whether should we all be organic or should we not be organic. It's really, again, thinking about the community. So you might have a backyard organic garden that's very appropriate for kind of that niche approach, or a rooftop greenhouse. But I think when you look at these enormous population centers like in China or India, where you have 10 million people, or look at the San Francisco Bay Area, we are hungry people. And we all want food on our table, and that's why most of it that is sourced now is not organic. But I think it's important to consider that it's not organic or conventional, that it's a continuum, right? So we don't want, I agree with Fred, we don't want indiscriminate spraying of insecticides, toxic chemicals. That's not the way of the future. We really need to look at the, 99% of the agriculture that's not certified organic and make those farms more sustainable. Use integrated cropping systems. Think of a combination of weed strategies so you're not just spraying one chemical, because that, as Fred has said, puts pressure to evolve weeds that are resistant to the insecticides. So what we're seeing in farms, you can go almost to any farm in the United States now, the farmers are innovating. They're trying different things. They're, as Fred said, they're maybe putting sort of an artificial closed environment on their farm for the part of the year where they can't grow the normal crop. So I think it's not organic or this idea of conventional where they spray a bunch of stuff. We don't want that either. But it's really a combination. It's being open to innovation, and it's keeping the goals in mind of sustainable agriculture that all of us have talked about.
We just have 1 minute left, so if anyone would like to make any sort of closing remark, sort of one last food for thought for the audience.
Well, thank you all,
Alex,
for coming.
Alex,
oh, yeah.
Anything?
I have so many things I want to say with what Pam just said, but I'll just say thank you for being interested in this very important topic.
Mona, anything? Final parting words?
I think, we really, it's obvious there's a need to be informed and to be our own advocates. And we can make very deliberate decisions about what we choose to eat and how we eat and how we engage in our communities, in our food systems.
Alexa?
I just want to remind everyone that if you want to try some of my kale from the greenhouse, just stick around and you'll get to try some. Don't tell the other rooms.
And,
just
and
for
I'll
you guys.
Just also add that there was a recent article in the Guardian newspaper that was a great reminder that what's on our plate and the most immediate threat to climate change is at your dinner table. It is not the car that you drive. It is not electricity and other energy use. The largest impact on climate change, if you want to make a difference, is what's on your plate. So as Mona said, we all have a choice every time we spend a dollar, choose to eat, to vote multiple times a day. So thank you so much to our panelists for being here.
Thank you.
And thank you for all the great questions.